This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, a fascinating conversation about a new book about John Glenn and the space race. But we are going to start today with Darren Brostrom. He is the Deputy Director of Job Service North Dakota and responsible for the unemployment insurance claims, which, as you can imagine, during a pandemic year has been quite an interesting time. And probably, I think, Darren, safe to say, you don't always want to use that word. Interesting might be a little bit complicated at times.
You're absolutely right. It's been a very interesting year with the pandemic.
What are, if you stop and let yourself really sink into just the last 14, 16 months, what are the top things that come to your mind as, wow, I really didn't see that coming?
Well, if I look back to the beginning, you always talked about pandemics over the years, but you never really realized the absolute impact and the economic impact that it would have on the state to have everything basically close or come close to closing. So I don't think anyone, and we were not necessarily prepared for the total numbers of individuals that would become unemployed and be impacted by this.
Yeah.
And it was coming right off the heels of oil prices declining pretty significantly, late 2019 and into 2020. And so there was kind of a double whammy at the same time.
Yeah, so refresh our memories. What did the unemployment claims actually get up to? I know it was low relative to the rest of the U.S., but for North Dakota, it was a big deal.
Yeah, very much so. We took, under regular state claims, we took about 158,000 claims.
Wow.
And then you add on top of that about 114,000 federal claims. So we were, we were around 275,000 claims. And in a typical year, we would have anywhere from 17,000 to 22,000.
That's a huge number increase.
Yeah, definitely.
What are some of the occupations? I know that the hospitality industries, hotels, anywhere that might be holding a convention, restaurants, very hard hit. What are some of the industries that are still struggling to come back?
Well, if you utilize just job openings for coming back, defining that, the top five industries we have for job openings are healthcare, transportation, which, truck driving, administration, sales, which would include retail, and food prep. And it's in that order. That's from one to five. So healthcare has got the most openings in North Dakota right now.
And give us a sense of those healthcare jobs. Is this a blanket, anyone in healthcare, please come work in North Dakota? Or are we getting more specific? We want people who are more skilled in one particular area of healthcare.
I think it's pretty broad, but nursing and nurses are always very high in demand. And I think they probably make up a large number of that.
How do you do the research on knowing what these top five sectors are?
Well, what we do is we have within Job Service, we have a unit that's called the Labor Market Information Unit. And they work very closely with the Bureau of Labor Statistics and gather information and do surveys in conjunction with each other to tell us what the economic picture and the employment picture looks like in North Dakota. And then additionally, we utilize data that we collect for job postings. Jobsnd.com is our website, and it is the most used job posting site in North Dakota because you can post for free and you have a pretty broad audience there. And so when we look at the number of job openings that we have, I'm referring to primarily what we pull from our website. And so there definitely could be other healthcare, other transportation postings on other private job boards. But the numbers that are the ranking of the top five that I quoted you came from our website and the job postings that have been made by employers on our website.
And at Job Service ND, do you have a sense of these job openings? Are they there because that many people left the workforce in the pandemic and they just, for whatever reason, either they moved out of state or they're just not ready to come back to work? Or are these jobs that are being created either because of the pandemic or just being created anyway?
Well, I think there's a combination of factors that come into play with this. And if you remember back to prior to the pandemic, you know, we had a workforce shortage, as does most of the nation right now, where there was some, the jobs were available, but we didn't have the people to fill it necessarily. And we, you know, as far as people leaving the state or out migration, you know, we'll know more as we get census data. There's later this year, we're going to get state census migration flows. And that'll tell us a lot of information. But anecdotally, we do project that there was some out-migration. And some of that's looking at various factors that we have. You know, 29% of the unemployment insurance claims we had went to out-of-state individuals. And those were people that had earnings in North Dakota that were ultimately, when they filed for unemployment insurance, the monies were going to them in another state. So that tells you that a fair number, you know, were not in North Dakota. And then we also look at the labor force. And we've seen the labor force, if you look at 2019, in April of 2019 versus April of 2021, it's down around 6,000 individuals, from about 408,000 people down to about 401,000 people. And so, you know, those two factors alone give us some anecdotal evidence that, okay, that there's some out-migration, but we're going to be looking very closely at the census data when it comes in.
And so that 29%, was that specific to a pandemic year?
You know, that's, it's really varied a lot over the last decade, primarily because of the oil industry. Prior to oil really booming strong in North Dakota, we would typically see around 10% of our claims be out of state. During oil price fluctuations, we've seen as high as 60% of claims being out of state. That was probably in that 2016 timeframe. But it's been going down until the pandemic. So I think it, the pandemic definitely impacted it, but I think oil impacted it as well.
What about the age groups that have been hardest hit, again, specific to the most recent past, the pandemic?
Sure. And we look at, when we talk about the population that we, that was hardest hit, we're always looking at those 18 or over. And there's going to be some under that, obviously, that are in the workforce. But the age group that got the hardest hit was the 25 to 39 age group. Mm. And they make up about 42.9% of the total population. So,
wow.
That's the group that got hit the hardest.
Yeah, and this is a group that's already first, second job right out of college. Pretty likely they've got a lot of college debt there. That's a really vulnerable age group.
It is, for sure. And then one factor that goes into play with that is that if you look at those individuals that were the hardest hit, when they answered the surveys that were sent out to them, most of them said that they had some college but had not received a degree. And so I don't have an answer as to how that impacts it at this point. But, you know, they may or may not have a level of college debt.
Is Job Service North Dakota at all able to be involved, and I'm not sure on what level this would really happen, from a tourism perspective or working with the state or with universities, is Job Service able to get involved in trying to recruit people to come to the state and combat that out-migration we've talked about?
Well, we absolutely collaborate with partners like the Department of Commerce, with the university system. You know, we're there and ready and able to work with any of those groups. We don't specifically have funding or a direction in order to recruit individuals. Job services funded, you know, 96% with federal funds. And so there's things that we can and can't spend those dollars on. But what we can do is collaborate and provide information and assist, you know, the communities, the economic developers in events that would bring people in and show them the benefits of North Dakota and what kind of pay they can expect and that sort of thing. So we definitely work with them.
You say a word like events and then once again throw in a pandemic when it's not exactly encouraged that we all get together and try and meet a room full of strangers and fly in from who knows where. What kinds of changes have you seen in terms of trends for recruitment?
Well, you know, that's recruitment is something that all states right now are really working on as far as in this, you know, pandemic and post-pandemic environment. You know, everyone's conscious of the situation. So there's a variety of tools that we have been evaluating and are investing in that allow for even virtual job fairs where individuals can meet up with employers in virtual meeting rooms. You know, there's a variety of training mechanisms and we utilize tools like Teams and Zoom in order to work with and collaborate with other groups that may have an event. You know, just even within our industry, when I say industry, the employment industry, we've had several virtual conventions, for lack of a better word, where we get together as the 50 states and have what we would typically have together in person virtually. And we've been learning and using the technology to make those things work.
Yeah, I saw an ad from, I believe it was West Virginia. There are, you know, maybe six towns in West Virginia that are paying people to move to West Virginia, but they have to already have jobs that they can keep and just work remotely. So not exactly a job fair, but quite an interesting take, I thought, on trying to encourage people to move to an area and then not even offer them a job.
I had seen that as well. And in fact, prior to the pandemic, states like Vermont were doing similar things to that to get folks to come in because of, you know, the telecommuting trend and the remote work trend, mm-hmm. you know, offering free lots and free houses and all kinds of things.
The modern day Homestead Act here.
Creativity is what's going to make things work. It's finding those tools and utilizing those tools and coming up with those unique ideas, I think, that will draw people in.
And can you give us an example of someone you think is doing a particularly good job at being unique and creative and expanding on what opportunities can be made out of our current situation?
Well, I think back here to a car dealership, and I haven't dealt directly with them, but my understanding is that they're offering a very good hourly wage to an individual to whoever they hire, providing, you know, a $500 allowance to pay for a car. And this is to be a salesman for a car dealership in North Dakota. So I think they're just looking at those things and saying, you know, what can we do? You can choose your hours. We're going to pay you a good wage and we're going to give you, you know, this benefit along with health insurance and that sort of thing. So that just comes to mind as something that seems like a neat idea. But I know there's other employers and groups that are offering other things that aren't coming to my mind right now.
Yeah, the example that I'm hearing just anecdotally in conversation over and over is people saying, yeah, McDonald's is paying $15 an hour and giving a $500 bonus. And this is not something that I independently verified, but people just talking about how jobs that we would have considered very much entry level and more so job than career focused, paying really well just to be able to get anybody to come into those jobs. And the complaint that keeps underscoring this is people saying that with the stimulus checks, people just don't want to work anymore. Have you seen that trend bear out?
You know, we, I think there's a combination of things, and I would say that the stimulus dollars have impacted some individuals, and you know they were pretty lucrative, and so North Dakota has made the decision to end those federal programs on June 19th. We're one of 25 states that are doing that, and I think that's in recognition in part that it is impacting employment, and things in North Dakota are really moving back fairly quickly now, kind of building up steam to a normal environment.
Are there certain regions of the state that have been harder hit than others?
There probably are. I don't have off the tip of my tongue what those regions are, but there's some regions had high unemployment coming into the pandemic. The very far north central part of the state, the western part of the state had oil hitting at the same time as the pandemic, so mm-hmm. so they were hit fairly hard, but they've been making a comeback. But what I would say is a really good source for that information is our website on jobsnd.com. We actually have an interactive map, if you will, a dashboard where you can see what industries were impacted in which counties and how many people had claims in those counties and that sort of thing. So that's a good source, a great place to really dive into the data. And it's very easy to understand. You know, the map of the counties lets you choose and look at industries and all those sorts of things.
Darren Brostrom is the Deputy Director of Job Service ND. Darren, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ashley.
Coming up next on Main Street, Harvest Public Media and a new game simulating farm work. That's after this break.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck, buying, selling, investing, and estate planning. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett.
And we are co-hosts of Away with Words. My background is in classical languages, and I never expected that I would be doing something every single day with ancient Greek, which is why I went into journalism. But this job combines both of those things in a really wonderful way.
I used to be a journalist as well, and an editor, and an IT guy. But I've always had an interest in language, and I had an opportunity to join the American Dialect Society and eventually become an editor of dictionaries for Oxford University Press, where I specialized in new words and slang. So you bring Martha's classical stuff with my new novel stuff, and I think we kind of cover the gamut of what has happened and has happened in English.
I don't really think it's a challenge to make this topic interesting to people because we all speak language, we all share stories, and people are a lot more curious about this than they realize. They might think initially, oh, this show isn't going to be interesting.
Yeah, they think it's two stuffy grammarians with corduroy jackets and patches on their elbows, but we're yes. not cobwebby old school marks. Join us every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain for Away with Words on member-supported Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Even though only 3% of Americans are currently farmers, a lot of people still identify with that ag lifestyle. And some of them have found an interesting way to connect by way of a live-action video game. We learn more from Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All.
Harley Hand is getting ready for a day on the farm.
Well, first, let me jump in a combine. We've got a soybean harvest, guys. We've got a big harvest, a bunch of fields that are ready to go.
He makes an adjustment to his equipment, and he's on his way.
Need to unfold the header. I guess it's okay. Well, let's fold it up. There we go. All right, let's roll.
But that sound, not a real combine. The Georgia native isn't really behind the controls of a big machine at all. He isn't even on a farm. He's in front of his computer in his house playing the game Farming Simulator and streaming the session online, where he regularly gets hundreds of people watching him play. Hans says a lot of his interactions with his audience are about learning the ins and outs of farming.
It's a huge learning experience for a lot of people that come into my streams. I've got a lot of people that know nothing about farming, and they come into the stream and they're like, oh really? That's how that works. And it's pretty cool.
Farming Simulator covers a lot of ground, from buying equipment to choosing crops, plowing, planting, fertilizing, and harvesting. A.K. Ramig is a gamer and writer who reviewed Farming Simulator for the website PC Invasion. He says the game is a lot like real farming.
The monotony, the tediousness, the length of time that it takes to plow a field in Farming Sim, it does give you an appreciation for what real farmers have to do, I would say, from my experience.
Monotony, tediousness, not the words you want to associate with something that people would do for fun. But Ramig, who lives in the Bahamas, says the game still has a lot of appeal.
And we don't have major scale farming here. You'll never see a John Deere tractor here, right? But it's still cool to me. It's still cool to see machines.
The game's so popular, playing it can actually be a full-time job. Harley Hand and several other streamers play the game online almost daily with hundreds of people watching. There's also a Farming Simulator esports competition that has sponsored teams competing for cash prizes up to $250,000, a lot more than what most farmers make in a year. And some of the game's most avid fans are farmers. Shelby Walker is a Southern Illinois native and a PhD candidate in agriculture communications at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. Her research shows some people who drive a real tractor all day will unwind by driving a virtual one.
The conditions aren't always perfect, but within the game, the conditions are always perfect. So it's almost like this fantasy. It's I get to do things in the digital realm that I don't get to do in real life.
She says it's a form of escapism to do it in a more predictable environment. Walker says the game also attracts people who may not be farmers, but feel connected to agriculture. That idea checks with streamer Harley Hand. He says all that tedious and monotonous time driving a combine, it allows him to connect with his audience.
A game like Farming Simulator allows you to interact with the people who are watching you a lot better than you can play in a game like Call of Duty. So it really, it becomes, you know, you're building a bunch of friendships and you begin to know everybody that's there.
Like here, when Hand reads a comment in his chat about a viewer who recently lost his home due to financial problems.
I hate to hear that, brother. Hopefully there's a turnaround somewhere, man. I'm sorry to hear that, brother. Hopefully everything gets better for you, dude.
Farming Simulator is scheduled to release a new version late this year. There's much speculation on whether it will add new features to make it even more realistic or keep it simple to attract a wider audience. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration covering America's ag and rural issues. Still to come on Main Street, handwritten letters from John Glenn before he went up on that famous but very dangerous mission back in 1962, orbiting the Earth. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota had 32 homicides in the year 2020. That compared with 26 in 2019.
It's the largest number of homicides in North Dakota since we started collecting this data in 1978, and probably the most serious we've ever had in the history of the state of North Dakota.
This is Attorney General Wayne Stengem.
12 of those 32 represent domestic violence cases. The rest were a compendium of different kinds of things. Some of them, a large number of them, had drug deals gone bad, arguments among people arguing over those kinds of things.
Stengem says Cass County reported 9 homicides, Minot had 7. The North Dakota Public Service Commission has denied a request by a North Dakota wind farm to delay replacement of the lights on top of the turbine towers. The old red blinking beacons have to be replaced on existing wind farm facilities by the end of the year. PPM Energy had asked for a year extension for the Rugby Wind Farm because of the potential for using what is called the LIDS system for light intensity dimming system instead of ALDS, or aircraft light detection system, where the lights would only come on where there is aircraft present in the area. PSC Chairman Shuly Fedorchuk says the Federal Aviation Administration was contacted about LIDS.
In that process, we learned that the first round of testing revealed some safety concerns by the FAA, and that they essentially told us that they didn't envision it being approved in time for the company to install it by an extended deadline of December 31st of 2022.
Fedorchuk says the current ALDS system was approved and is already working for some other wind farms. Commissioner Brian Crotchis says Rugby Wind has been given adequate time to make the change in the lighting system.
The other consideration is that the citizens were promised that the skies would be dark again, so it's time to accomplish that.
Commissioners say the one main complaint they hear about wind turbines is that the flashing red lights are a nuisance and do not allow stargazing. And 15 area fire departments, police departments, ambulance services, and other first response teams participated in a disaster simulation at the Hector International Airport in Fargo this morning. Airport Fire Chief David Bush says dozens of volunteers were on hand to play the parts of victims of an airplane crash. He says they are asked to be really be pains in the butt to make the scene as chaotic and realistic as possible.
The simulation is going to be that there was a collision between a Citation 500 and a CRJ 900 aircraft. And they were just on the ramp, or they were waiting to taxi, and ended up the Citation ran into this commercial aircraft.
Bush says the FAA requires the teams to conduct a simulation every 3 years.
When you talk about mass casualty incidents, which, you know, planes or commercial aircraft usually have upwards from anywhere from 60 to 200 people on them, that is, well, you're well into a mass casualty event, and you have to multiply, you have to bring in multiple agencies to take care of that. The communications between the agencies, the interactions, how they work together, how the command structure works, all needs to be practiced. So if, when in the event of this really happening, they have a good foundation to begin mitigating the emergency.
Bush says the teams are grateful for the participation of the volunteer actors. He says participation is not as high as usual, more than likely due to the COVID-19 pandemic. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Looking for Europe in the USA?
It is by far, for me, the most European city in the United States.
Respecting the power of the wind in Iceland?
It won't take you prisoner, it'll just flick you off the map.
And surviving a rocky night on a cruise ship stranded in an Arctic storm.
It was so bad that the baby grand piano flipped upside down.
It's on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And I don't know about you, but tomorrow morning I am going to be getting up early and looking up at the solar eclipse. We are going to have that ring of fire eclipse. And a lot of people like me are drawn to looking up and seeing what's happening in space. Sometimes it's a rare natural phenomenon, and sometimes it is because of this human endeavor and science and imagination that actually puts people into space. And we are going to visit with Jeff Schessel. He is the author of Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Ashley. It's good to be here.
So, John Glenn, third American in space, first American to orbit the Earth. He circled it three times in the 60s. He was a senator. I think at one point somebody tried to punch him during a press conference, and he subdued this person. He flew a lot of different combat missions, I believe 149 across World War II and in Korea. Quite an American legend. What made you want to write about this specific mission, the Friendship 7, when he goes up in 1962 to orbit Earth?
Well, John Glenn was a legend, as you described. Legends aren't always as interesting as you hope they will be when you when you dig in and learn about them. I found in John Glenn's case, he was more interesting. And this is one of the things that, that really made me excited about writing this book. John Glenn, for anyone who's seen The Right Stuff, who for anyone who's read any of the books about the period, he's inevitably described as a Boy Scout, as a Sunday school teacher. And he was those things. He was both of those. He was authentically himself in front of the cameras. And yet, at the same time, it always seemed to me, as I read about his accomplishments in space and during that period, that there had to be more to it than that. And in fact, the John Glenn that I found in going through his archives and in talking to many of the folks who served with him at NASA in one capacity or other, he was in fact a more complex character than that. He was he was edgier. He was more ambitious. He was more fiercely competitive. As you mentioned, Ashley, he was a sort of a sunny astronaut, cheerful, good-natured, aw shucks, but he was also, as you pointed out, a highly decorated combat veteran of two wars, in fact, both World War II and Korea. And he was known, particularly in Korea, for being somebody who would take the greatest chances and risks, that he would sometimes disobey his commanding officers and circle back to make a second attack on a target, because he was that determined to hit the target. And one of these times he wound up with a hole blown in the tail of his jet the size of a basketball. And he somehow got this plane back to base and then cheerfully posed for photographs with it. So John Glenn was a more interesting character than that. And his time at NASA, while it kind of looks from our perspective like a highlight reel, at the time was full of conflict and conflict of real consequence. Conflict over the question, for example, of whether astronauts were going to be allowed to do anything in those space capsules, or whether they were expected to be passengers who sat quietly while the autopilot did all the work. That was one of the issues.
That doesn't sound like John Glenn.
Of real concern. It doesn't sound like John Glenn or any of the Mercury 7, really. And so there was a lot of tension over that question.
Yeah, just the way that you even added more depth to his character sounds very much like the kind of person that I would want to pick to pilot this mission. Take us back to this time period of this space race. And it's not Sputnik. It's not the first person in space, Yuri Gagarin. Where does this specific mission with the Mercury 7 astronauts on Friendship 7 fit into the missions of the time?
Well, it's worth taking, as you did, a couple of steps back to the beginning of the space race. It was really kicked off by Sputnik, as you said, in 1957, when the Soviets were the first to send a satellite into orbit around the Earth, which terrified Americans and terrified many people around the world for what it meant. Because the Soviets, for all their talk, nobody really imagined that they had peaceful purposes in mind in space. And so what would they do? What were they building toward? You talked earlier about looking up in wonder at the heavens and at the moon and the eclipse. Well, when people looked up in that moment and they saw the little glint of what they thought was Sputnik, but it was actually the booster rocket, you could see the glint of it from Earth in dark spots around the country, that they were terrified. They were terrified to see this going above the United States. And there was a lot of concern, not just on the part of ordinary Americans, but even defense experts and others at universities around the country, about the ability, they imagined, of the Soviets to build a floating space platform that would just hang above the United States permanently, armed to the teeth with nuclear missiles that could drop missiles on the United States at the slightest provocation. They talked seriously, and I do mean seriously, about the idea of a Soviet nuclear base on the moon. Now, it was never clear why that would be more advantageous to the Soviets than nuclear base in the middle of Siberia, which is frankly a lot closer to the United States. But nonetheless, anything seemed possible because Sputnik was just the beginning. And in short succession, the Soviets sent the first animal into orbit. They sent a dog like it into orbit. They sent an unmanned craft to crash land onto the moon, which was the first time anything built by humans had touched the lunar surface. It was one thing after another building toward Yuri Gagarin's flight, his orbit around the Earth in April 61. And there was a sense of building foreboding in the United States that the Soviets were, if, as John Kennedy said in 1960 when he ran for president, if the Soviets control space, they can control Earth. So there was a lot of fear and a lot of concern. And almost a year passed mm-hmm. between Yuri Gagarin's orbiting the Earth and John Glenn's orbiting the Earth, becoming the first American to do so. That's a lot of time to worry about a lot of things.
Yeah. Imaginations tend to run wild. Part of the reason that it took a year, though, is there were some significant delays faced by this mission. What is happening on Earth and in the sky in the moments leading up to the initial launch dates for this?
There were a lot of setbacks along the way. The program was just not moving forward as quickly as it was supposed to here in the United States. I mean, first of all, we didn't even actually have a space program, a mm-hmm. proper space program, until after Sputnik. NASA, Sputnik, as I said, went up in 1957. NASA wasn't created until a year later. And it was really created in a way in response to Sputnik, in response to the mounting threat that the Soviets had posed. There were projects underway, mostly being run by the military branches. The Air Force had its own, the Army had its own, and so forth. And Eisenhower in 1958 said, we're gonna pull all of the scientific work and the manned exploration together in a new agency. We're gonna create this thing called NASA. So the United States was behind from the beginning. One of the reasons that we were delayed was, in a way, an irony. We had these very sophisticated missiles. We were designing them to be lighter and more efficient and more effective and easier to target. The Soviets, by contrast, had this big lumbering missile that they called the Semyorka. And it was very difficult to aim. It was difficult to hide. It was difficult to maneuver. It was not particularly effective as a potential weapon. But one thing it was really great at was thrust. It was great at pushing heavy objects higher and higher and into orbit. Our rockets were not designed to do that at first, and so they weren't powerful enough to get objects into orbit. And so when we finally broke into the human space race in 1961, the first two U.S. space flights were called suborbitals. They rode a rocket that wasn't powerful enough to get them into orbit, so they went up, and they came down and splashed into the ocean. 15 minutes was as long as the entire thing took. And it was just going to take more time before our more powerful rockets were ready. And our more powerful rockets, namely the Atlas rocket that John Glenn wound up riding, they had a terrible tendency to blow up on the launch pad. They had a terrible track record. And so it took months and months to get to a point where NASA felt safe enough to send a human being up on top of one of these things. And even at that point, when they finally made that determination and said that John Glenn would ride one of these, the president of the company, Convair Astronautics, that built that rocket would only credit it with an 80% chance of succeeding.
Oh,
80%, nice. Which meant that he thought there was a 1 in 5 chance of a terrible tragedy. So those were the stakes, and they were pretty ominous in most people's view.
We're visiting today with Jeff Schessel. He is the author of Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War. He is a historian and former presidential speechwriter. And Jeff, we're talking about being in a dangerous situation. And you gave this statistic of there was only a 1 in 5 chance of there being danger associated with this, but that seems like too high of odds for me. There's been a lot that's been written about John Glenn and about the space race. What sets Mercury Rising for me anyway, what sets us apart is that there is some very personal touches that you got from handwritten letters from the late John Glenn. How did you come across these that they haven't been anywhere else yet?
Well, I did a lot of digging at the Glenn Archives at Ohio State, which haven't been open terribly long, so I don't know that many researchers have worked with those files yet. But I also, frankly, got lucky, as researchers sometimes do, in finding exciting, important things that maybe others haven't seen before. And what you're referencing is a couple of things. One is that on the eve of his flight, as he sat in isolation at Cape Canaveral, waiting and waiting for the weather to clear and for other technical problems to be cleared up, Glenn really was ruminating about the possibility that he would become the first man to die in space. Mm. It was really all coming home to him in that moment that he'd always faced danger. I mean, any fighter pilot faces danger on a daily basis, any test pilot, his job is to face danger. But there was something about sitting on top of that rocket, which had such a terrible record of blowing up on the launch pad, and thinking, this might be it for him. And so he wrote his children a long, long letter, letting them know all the things that he wanted them to hear before he would go on a mission like this. And he said in this letter, look, I'm very confident in this mission, and I really believe that I'm going to be coming back safely, but I want you to know these things. And then he sat and stewed some more and thought, maybe I haven't said everything that I wanted to say. So he wrote himself on yellow legal paper a script for a recording that he then made on a reel-to-reel recorder. Mm-hmm. He made one recording for his kids and one for his wife, Annie, that would only be played in the event that he did not come back safely, that he did not come back alive from the mission. And the script for his kids begins on a really blunt note. Mm-hmm. He says, if you hear this, I've been killed. And he says, let's talk about funerals, specifically about a funeral at Arlington where there probably wouldn't, he said, be a body because of the nature of the tragedy. And so he talked to his two teenage children about how he wanted them to conduct themselves. And he even said that he would send them a signal from the afterlife. Glenn was very religious. He was a deeply devout Presbyterian. He strongly believed in an afterlife, and he wanted his kids to know that he was going to be okay. And he arranged for a signal that he would send them from the other side. It's a very chilling, very powerful reading. And he went ahead and he made these recordings. And when Glenn was finally strapped into that capsule atop that Atlas rocket on February 20th, 1962, and he was about to take off, he had a last conversation, what might have been his very last conversation with Annie at home in Arlington. And one of the last things he said to his wife was, did you get the recordings that I sent you? And it was very important to him that the family had those recordings. And she said, yes, she had received them. And so this was very present on his mind as he prepared to lift off.
Yeah, two of the lines that stand out to me in this letter to his kids are, courage is only present when there is also fear. And human progress has never been fostered by the cowards who have let fear rule their lives. There's something so telling in there that both of these lines have the word fear in there. Because I don't know, to me anyway, we like to let ourselves believe that these people don't have fear and that's why they can do it and I can't, for example. But he seemed very aware and very unwilling to let fear take over.
It's a very powerful lesson that he was giving his kids in that moment. And in a way, he was reinforcing it for himself in writing about it.
Yeah.
He was very frank that he would be afraid, that there's something really terrifying about sitting on top of this rocket. And by the way, if the rocket doesn't explode, then you have to deal with the vacuum of outer space, which contained all sorts of other
right.
dangers and unknowns. And so he was honest with himself and with his children that he was going to be afraid, but this is where courage comes in, where courage kicks in, is when you have a confidence in yourself and your abilities, when you understand the technology, when you understand the mission, that these are all of the elements that are important in restoring your sense of courage. That courage doesn't mean anything if you're actually fearless. If you're fearless, then no call for courage. Mm. Courage is called for when you are facing dangerous and existential odds.
Also in the book, there is an outline of things he wants to say to Annie, and it just is notes to Annie. What if? Had many years together. Interlude, which I think is an interesting note. Remarry. Wonderful person and mother. Vibrant and alive. And it was very easy for me to put myself in the situation of, if I'm facing danger and I need to write a letter to my husband and I can't get down anything more than just a couple of notes. Did anything stand out to you as you're looking through this list? I got kind of a lump in my throat when I thought about remarriage.
Boy, I did too. And isn't it amazing that, again, Glenn is just about to fly into space, into orbit, if he makes it, is thinking about, he wants Annie, the love of his life, to know that it is okay with him, that someday that she would remarry. He just wants there to be no question about that fact for her as she goes on with the rest of her life. And I think the interlude, it's hard to know, but it seems the interlude that he's alluding to there is that he understands that there will be a period where she's going to grieve, but then he wants her to go on with her. He wants her to know this from him, that this comes from him and that it's blessed by him. And it's incredibly poignant. That is all that is left, to my knowledge. And believe me, I looked through the archives and elsewhere. That is all that is left of the script to Annie. But those few notes that you just read are very powerful, and they speak to this incredible relationship. You know, in a way, the two of them, John and Annie Glenn, were together for over 90 years because they were introduced when they were 2 and 3 years old in a playpen in their little town of New Concord. The families were friends. And so they grew up together. And the first photos we have of them together are as teenage sweethearts. And they went on to get married after Pearl Harbor and were together the rest of their lives. And they both lived very long lives.
Jeff Schessel is the author of Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War. He is a historian and former presidential speechwriter, and you can find out more at Schessel.com, S-H-E-S-O-L. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ashley. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's lifelong learning community. Information about classes and events at humanitiesnd.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 9th. Yesterday, we heard how the polio vaccine, developed by Dr. Jonas Salk's team, arrived in North Dakota. On this date, in 1955, North Dakota held its first polio vaccination clinics. At the World War Memorial Building in Bismarck, 981 children, ages 6 to 9, were vaccinated. They streamed into the building from buses and got in line, looking ahead in curiosity. They bared their arms and looked away when it was their turn for the shot. It wasn't easy for everybody. One boy resisted and was held by four nurses and his mother. Other parents were reluctant about the vaccine. One mother thought a long time before letting her 6-year-old daughter get vaccinated. The National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, also known as the March of Dimes, provided the vaccine free of charge for first and second graders in North Dakota. Under that program, in 1955, 59% of those children were vaccinated, more than 17,800 kids. Vaccination rates ranged from 24% in Oliver County to 88% in Renville County. The federal government also provided $134,000 for vaccinating people ages 19 and younger and pregnant women. A shortage of vaccine was a challenge. The vaccinations were the chief priority of public health nurses, whose work also included tuberculosis testing and rehabilitation services for the elderly, chronically ill, and people with disabilities. In summarizing the first year of polio shots, North Dakota's director of public health wrote, "Never in the history of the state has there been such an extensive effort to wipe out a dreaded disease." 1955 ended with the second fewest polio cases in North Dakota over the last 10 years. Dr. Albert Sabin soon developed an oral polio vaccine, which was taken with sugar. Like Salk shot, it generated mass turnouts. As many as 16,000 people were vaccinated in one day in Stutsman County in 1963. Vaccinations eliminated polio in the U.S. by 1979. But it has not yet been eradicated from the world, with cases persisting in Afghanistan and Pakistan. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was paralyzed from polio at the age of 39, helped found the March of Dimes, which raises money for vaccine research and patient care. His image has been on the dime since 1946, an everyday reminder of the polio story. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we are joined by Professor Joseph Ellis and the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Clay Jenkinson, and the two of them answer listener questions.
The eminent Professor Joseph Ellis, now retired and in an undisclosed location in Vermont, answers questions about Jefferson and the Haitian Revolution, Jefferson and his honeymoon and marriage to Martha Wales Skelton in 1772, and a question about the signers of the Declaration of Independence. How important are they, since most of them we don't know much about? Would it be in our interest to know more, or are they rightly obscure? And which of the signers of the Declaration are overrated and which underrated?
And their answers to that question may surprise you. Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, there are about 7 billion humans on Earth. Yeah, that's a big number. You want to hear a bigger one? 17 quadrillion. That's 17 with 15 zeros, and that's the number of flies there are on Earth. We're going to visit with the author of Superfly, The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.